Good afternoon again, brethren. It's hard not to say good morning. I'll be in the book of John for most of the message this afternoon. I've always been fascinated with John. I guess he's one of the two people other than Jesus himself that really captures my interest in his life. Remember, John was the one that was taken up to heaven in a vision, or he wasn't even quite sure it was a vision. It was so real to him, he said he didn't know whether it was really a vision or if he was really there. But he was able to see things that he was not even permitted to tell us about. He's the one that saw the angel that came down and gave him a little book and told him to eat it. And he said, in your mouth it'll be sweet as honey, but in your belly it'll be bitter. He was the one that he heard the seven thunders, and he was about to write them and tell us about them. And he heard a voice from heaven that said, don't write them. So to this day, you know, we don't know for sure what those seven thunders were, but John, to say the least, he led a very, very interesting life. He had a lot of trouble. He was exiled to Patmos, but he wrote several books of the Bible. And he recorded only seven miracles of Jesus Christ. And right away, that gets my attention. Why only seven? Because John also said, if all the things that Jesus Christ did were written, there wouldn't be enough room in the world to hold all of the books. And then he picked only seven miracles to record. Now, we know that Jesus did many more than seven, so why did John pick seven? And why these particular seven? So, if you'll open your Bible and turn to John chapter 2, and we'll start reading in verse 1 of John chapter 2. It says, in the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were called to the marriage, but they ran out of wine. And the mother told Jesus, they have no wine. Skipping on down to verse 6, he told them to fill up. They had about six water pots made of stone. He told them to fill them up with water. And each one of these water pots containing two or three firkins apiece. Now, depending on whether it was two or three, that amounts to 120 gallon or 160 gallon. So that's no small amount of wine. So the water was turned to wine. We know that. Jesus told them to fill it up with water. And then at verse 9 it says, water was made wine. In verse 11, this was the beginning of miracles that Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. So he turned the water to wine, but it's the beginning of miracles. And at least unto my mind, it corresponds to the beginning of the holy days, or the holy day season, if you will. Jesus began his ministry about 6 months before this, and during that time he had chosen his 12 apostles. No doubt he was looking forward to his very first Passover in Jerusalem after he started his ministry. So he was thinking about the Passover at this time. And what is the relationship between wine and the Passover? Remember, this is the first miracle. This is actually the first miracle that we know about that Jesus did. Well, wine represents Jesus Christ's spilled blood. It was top quality wine. You know, if we read the whole thing here, we'd find out it's top quality wine, representing the nature of Jesus Christ, his righteousness and his great position in the universe and his power. But to me, this first miracle that, Jesus Christ did, it ties in very well with the first holy day gathering. You know, you could argue if the Passover is not really a holy day, but it is a commanded assembly, and it's very important. And without it, none of the rest of them has any meaning whatsoever. So it's the first miracle, the first feast day or holy day. It's when we come together to honor Christ's sacrifice, and we honor it with the bread, of course, but also with the wine, which represents the spilled blood of Jesus Christ. Red wine. Okay, let's go right away into the second miracle, because the first time I gave this sermon was back in the worldwide many, many years ago, and I was looking for some subject to speak on, and I found an old article that was about 12 pages long that I wrote many, many years ago, and it was about this very subject. And I've given it as a sermon many, many times, but for my time today, I'm going to have to cut it down. I'll just hit the high points. The second miracle we find in John 4. If you'll turn to John 4, we'll start reading in verse 46. This is the second miracle that John recorded, I should say. Verse 46, so Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine. There was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard about Jesus, that he had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went unto him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, because he was at the point of death. And Jesus said, except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. So belief is a major theme in this miracle, belief or faith. So the nobleman encouraged him to come on down, and says, my child's going to die. In verse 50, Jesus said unto him, go your way, your son liveth. And then, of course, the nobleman started back home, and we read in verse 52, he inquired of those who had met him, the servants had met him, about the hour when his son began to amend. And they said that it was about the same hour that Jesus had said unto him, your son lives. At the very same time, that son started to heal. Now, this, the second miracle, the fact that he mentions a second miracle is interesting to me in itself, because it was not the first, it was not the second miracle that Jesus Christ did. It was the second miracle that he did after he came out of Judea back to Cana of Galilee. Well, if it's the second miracle he did after he came back, why did not John mention the first miracle that he did? No mention of it whatsoever. So, this is the second miracle that John recorded. It's the second miracle that Jesus did after he came back from Jerusalem. But we know from the Bible that Jesus did many miracles in Jerusalem while he was there at the Passover. And many people were converted because they were with Jesus at Jerusalem when he did those miracles, and they came back into Galilee and they began to have more respect for him, and more people, you know, were added. Actually, during Jesus' ministry, as far as we know, there were only 120 disciples. But this is a healing. The second miracle, second holy day we're talking about. So what happens the second holy day, the days of unleavened bread? It is the time when we begin to heal. You know, God's Spirit begins to work with us. We begin to heal spiritually. And also, if we follow God's health laws and truly obey Him, we begin to heal physically as well. I've known many people whose health has improved dramatically after they found out about God's laws, and they really began to take care of their body, realizing that their body is the temple of God if we have God's Spirit. So it's a healing. not just physically, but especially spiritually. It's a healing. Our whole life after we're converted is a time of healing. We're growing towards perfection, becoming more and more like Jesus Christ. So belief is required, you know, in order to go through our life and add to our faith constantly until we're ready to be in God's kingdom. The second miracle. The second feast day, days of unleavened bread, it's the time when our faith begins. We begin to believe in Jesus Christ, and it continues for the remainder of our physical life. Now, I need to move on. So we go to the third miracle. The third miracle that John recorded. In John 5, we'll start reading in verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folks, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season. Notice that this happened at a certain season. A season only happens once a year. You know, our seasons, we have spring, summer, fall, winter. It's a season. But this angel came down at a certain season, a certain time of year, if you will, into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatever disease he had. This had been going on for some time. And a certain man was there, which had an infirmity, 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie, and knew that he had been there a long time, in that case he said unto him, "Will you be made whole?" The impotent man answered and said, "Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said unto him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked. And then if we read on, we realize that some of the Jews made a big fuss about this because he was carrying his bed on the Sabbath day. This was a Sabbath day. As well as a certain time of year, it was a Sabbath day. So that is an indication that it was a high day, a day that comes at a certain season, not a day that comes every single week of the year. So it was a high day. Until recently, most of the scholars, and you can look this up in the various commentaries and Bible helps, they believed that this was another Pentecost. And even those that did not agree with them, they could not come to an agreement on which day it may have been. To me, it seems quite obvious which day it was because of all of the signs that are portrayed in this miracle. One thing, well, I've already mentioned it's a certain season, which is a certain time of year. It was a Sabbath day. Weekly Sabbaths, you know, don't come in all seasons. Holy days come at a certain season. So there is the coming of the Spirit. What does that remind you of? In this miracle, a Spirit came down from heaven. And what did the Spirit do? The Spirit troubled the water. When we first begin to learn of God's way of life, what happens to us? If you're like me, you become a little bit troubled. God's Spirit begins to show you that there's things that you should have been doing that you are not doing. And also that there is things that you probably are doing, or, you know, it's vice versa. Things you're not doing, you should do. Things you are doing, you should not do. So you're troubled somewhat. And that leads you to a repentance. again, to me, this ties in perfectly with the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit comes down and begins to trouble us a little bit so that we begin to pay some attention to God's way of life and begin to understand it a little bit. The water. What does water represent? The water represents God's Spirit, for one thing, but it also represents a baptism. So what was happening here, the people had to be dunked into the water before they would be healed. Again, a clear tie-in to the third holy day, which is the day of Pentecost. That's the coming of God's Spirit to those that are called in this particular age. It happened, you know, it began at the first New Testament day of Pentecost. Before that, only a very, very few people had God's Spirit. Now, I need to move on to the fourth miracle. The fourth miracle. And this is found in John 6. We'll start reading in verse 8. But to set the stage, a great multitude had followed Jesus Christ out into the wilderness, in a wilderness area, and there was a discussion about how they could feed such a large multitude of people. Then in verse 8 of John 6, one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a lad here which has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. But what are they among so many?" And Jesus said, "Make the men sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. Some people believe that that only included the men, because it does say the men sat down. And from that they extrapolate that there was probably maybe 2 or 3 times that many more, if you include the women and children, that may have been out there. I don't know about that. I can't prove that one way or the other, but we do know that there were 5,000 people there to be fed. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were set down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they would. In verse 12, when they were filled, he said to the disciples, "Gather up the fragments so that nothing will be lost." In verse 13, they gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the barley loaves and the fishes. And we know that there was 12 basketfuls, and they had fed 5,000 people. Now, how does this tie in? This, the fourth miracle, the fourth feast day, and what is the fourth feast day or high day? Trumpets. Trumpets is when the bread of life, of course, is Jesus Christ himself. And we can read in John 6:35, and Jesus said unto them, "I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger." In John 6:48, "I am the bread of life." And he goes on down and he mentions it 2 or 3 times. Going down to verse 51, he says, "I am the bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." So we are talking about the bread of life. And Jesus Christ is the bread of life that came down from heaven. And that is when the great multitudes that come up in the first resurrection will begin to be fed of this, by and of this bread of life, Jesus Christ. They will begin to be fed. Their mind will be opened up. They will have God's Spirit. God's Spirit will be available to everyone, not just a select few. So, it, to me, again, it represents this fourth miracle perfectly. It is the fourth feast day. It's when Christ returns. It's the first resurrection. God's Spirit will be available to all, and the multitudes, for the first time, will be fed directly by this bread of life. It ties right in to the fourth holy day, which is trumpets. You know, it's when Christ returns. It's trumpets. Now, let's move on to the fifth miracle that John records. In John 6 and verse 15, when Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. And when the evening was come, his disciples went down into the sea and entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh unto the ship. And they were afraid. They were afraid. You could say they lacked faith. But he said unto them, "It is I, be not afraid." Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was at the land where they went. Now, Matthew records this very same thing, but he adds a little bit to it. So if you want to turn there, if you turn to Matthew 14, verse 27, we'll read his account. It's the same miracle that John recorded, but he adds a little bit. Matthew adds something that John leaves out. Matthew 14, verse 27. But straightway Jesus spoke unto them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." You know, that's where we left off in John. And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it be you, bid me to come unto you on the water." And he said, "Come." And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Peter walked on the water. Verse 30, but when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid. You know, Jesus had just said to him, "Be not afraid." So fear or lack of faith runs throughout this miracle. And beginning to sink, because of his fear, he began to sink, even though he had been walking on the water. And he cried, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, "O you of little faith," or we could substitute, you who are fearful, you who lack the belief that you should have, "O you of little faith, wherefore did you doubt?" Why did you doubt? Now, this fifth miracle, and it ties into the fifth feast day, which is atonement. What happens on atonement? Satan is bound. From that time forward, Satan is bound. He is thrown into the bottomless pit and sealed up. He no longer has power to put doubts into our mind. And we evidently will be able to walk on water or under the water or in the air, or fly through the air, or do what we want to do. Again, this fifth miracle ties in my mind at least. I'm not trying to say that you have to believe it, but it ties in very well to the fifth feast day, to atonement, when Satan will not be around anymore to mess with our belief system. Those of us in the first resurrection at that time will have perfect belief. We will sin no more. We will have no doubts. We'll have no one to mislead us and cause us to doubt. We'll believe God perfectly. Now, move on to the sixth miracle. The sixth miracle. And that's found in John chapter 9. John chapter 9. We'll start reading right in verse 1. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did this? No, who did sin? Who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? You know, they were trying to attribute sin to the fact that the man was blind. But Jesus answered and said, neither has this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. Evidently, this man was blind from his birth for this very purpose, so that he could be given his sights to teach us a profound lesson. I must work the works of him. Verse 4, I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night comes when no man can work. He's making a comparison here between day and night about being blind or seeing, if you will. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground, made clay of the spittle, and anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. In verse 7, it said unto him, go wash in a pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. He went his way therefore and washed and came seeing. So the man who had been blind from his birth was given sight. Again, we're talking about the sixth miracle that John recorded in his gospel. And it ties into the sixth feast day, which is the Feast of Tabernacles, the millennium, at the time when the masses will no longer be blinded from God's truth. We know from the Bible that the vast majority of people on earth today are blinded. God is going to remove that blindness. And it will be removed during the Feast of Tabernacle, which represents the next 1,000 years after Jesus Christ comes. People will be taught. They will have God's Spirit available to them. They will be able to understand what they're taught. The blindness will be removed from the world. A direct tie-in from removing the blindness from a man who had been blind from his birth for the very purpose of teaching this lesson that will happen on the seventh holy day, during the 1,000 years, if you will, the millennium, which is the sixth holy day season. Well, let's move on to the seventh miracle. And we find that in John 11. John 11. And verse 5. Now Jesus, verse 5. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was when he heard it. Then after that, said he unto his disciples, let us go into Judea again. In verse 11, these things said he, and after that he said unto them, our friend Lazarus sleeps. And then there was some discussion about that, and they said, well, if he's asleep, you know, he'll be all right. He's doing good. And finally, in verse 14, Jesus said plainly unto them, Lazarus is dead. And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there. To the intent you may believe, nevertheless, let us go unto him. And he was about to teach another great concept of God's plan. Let's drop down to verse 20. He goes on to Judea. And, of course, then in verse 20, Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary still stayed at home. Then said Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, whatsoever you will ask of God, God will give it. And Jesus said unto her, Your brother shall live again. And listen to what Martha said. Martha said unto him, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She even mentions the last day, tying it directly in to the last great day, which is the seventh festival of God. She said, I know he'll come up in the resurrection the last great day. That's the second resurrection. Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, he shall live. And going down now to verse 39, Jesus said, after they went up to the tomb where Lazarus was buried, Jesus said, take you away this stone. And Martha, the sister of him that was dead, said unto him, Lord, by this time he stinketh. For he's been dead 4 days. And Jesus said unto her, said I not unto you that if you would believe, you should see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I knew that you hear me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that you have sent me. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. The seventh miracle that John recorded, the seventh feast day, which represents the great white throne judgment, the resurrection, the second resurrection, the great resurrection. And here, Jesus taught it, and John recorded it for our benefit, so that we could see the tie-in and know that God has the power to raise us up even though we die, and that he will raise up every last human being that has ever lived on this earth. The seven miracles of John. To me, in my mind, it portrays the seven feast days, the whole plan of God. Remember, John was the one that said that if everything Jesus Christ had done, there wouldn't be enough room to hold all of the books. But he chose these seven miracles of John. And they were not in order of the way that Jesus Christ did them. I mean, he didn't start with number one, number two, number three. He picked these for a special reason, these seven. And he related them in order of the feast days themselves. That's another thing. You know, the order is correct. You know, you don't get number four first and number seven second. It's one, two, three, right on through seven. That is the order in which that he recorded them. Could it be that John was laying out for us the entire plan of God for humankind?